Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Jewish Studies, a podcast channel of New Books Network. I'm your host, Schneer Zalman Neufeld. New York City's Lower East Side has witnessed a severe decline in its Jewish population in recent decades. Yet every morning in the big room of the city's oldest yeshiva, students still gather to study the Talmud beneath the great arched windows facing out onto East Broadway. In Yeshiva Days, Learning on the Lower East Side, published by Princeton University Press in 2020, Jonathan Boyarin presents a uniquely personal account of the year he spent as both a student and observer at Mesivta Teferis Yerushalayim, and a poignant chronicle of a side of Jewish life that outsiders rarely see. Boyarin explores the yeshiva's relationship with the neighborhood, the city, and Jewish and American culture more broadly, and brings vividly to life its routines, rituals, and rhythms. Jonathan Boyarin is the Diane G. and Thomas A. Mann Professor of Modern Jewish Studies at Cornell University. His books include Jewish Families, Mornings at the Stanton Street Shul, A Summer on the Lower East Side, and The Unconverted Self, Jews, Indians, and Identity of Christian Europe. Thank you, Jonathan, so much for joining us.
Thanks for the conversation. I'm looking forward to it very much, Zalman.
Oh, I'm glad. So I wanted to start off by asking you to talk about your background. I always ask the guests to talk about their background and what brought them to produce the work that we're discussing. And in your case, given this particular book, it's especially a relevant question. So tell us a little bit about your background and what brought you to write this book.
I think the first part of the answer is the same as I would give if we were talking about my previous book about the Lower East Side, Mornings at the Stanton Street Shul, because the first part of the story about how I came to spend time at the yeshiva on East Broadway, for me, has to do with how I came to be a resident of the Lower East Side. I wasn't born there, like a lot of people who still live in the Jewish community on the Lower East Side, and like a lot of the fellows who still study in the Big Beis Medrash at MTJ. I came from a Jewish chicken farming community in Farmingdale, New Jersey, and not necessarily from a particularly observant family, but certainly there was yeshiva background. If you went back a generation or two, I talk about that a little bit in the book. And my idea of shul was formed in my early childhood by the very Hamish, informal yet traditional services in the Jewish Community Center in Farmingdale, New Jersey. And I didn't really want to go to shul once we left that in my still relatively early childhood until I was on my own and moved to New York City and started graduate school and found myself a cheap apartment on the Lower East Side, which was the first time I'd felt at home since I left Farmingdale. And I said, well, when I find a shul that feels like Farmingdale, I'll start going to shul again. And someone I knew through Yiddish circles, somebody involved in rescuing Jewish material culture on the Lower East Side, said, you know, I know a place where they'll really welcome you. They need you, and they'll welcome you. And that was the 8th Street Shul, believe it or not, on East 8th Street between Avenue B and C. That's east of Tompkins Square Park. And we're talking about 1979, 1980, when half of the buildings on those blocks were bombed out, essentially. Not just there weren't many Jews there, there weren't many people living there at all. And some hardy souls who had moved down to Grand Street and didn't want to give up their shul kept the place going and were indeed happy to have a guy with a ponytail walk in and count for the minyan. And in some ways, that was the first time that I became aware of the ways that the Lower East Side Orthodox community is tolerant, stretches itself in an unusually pretentious and welcoming way.
Unusually pretentious or unpretentious?
Unpretentious, yeah. I mean, it's so unpretentious, it's almost pretentious. to channel Jackie Mason for a second. In the early 80s, my wife, Alyssa Sampson, and I went to Paris for a year, where I did fieldwork for my dissertation in anthropology, which was a study of elderly Polish Jews in Paris. And these were not religious people. They were dafka not. These were mostly ex-communists, Yiddish speakers, amazing people with incredible life stories, and I admired them tremendously. But one thing I noticed was that they had not been able to pass much on to their children. Their children were not part of a community in the way they had been. And even the Yiddish culture that informed them, that was so rich, I understood was rich in part because it was informed by the traditional Jewish culture that they were rebelling against. And when Alyssa and I moved back to the Lower East Side, I think she shared this, had some sense that you can't really pass on Jewishness without some everyday frame of this is what Jews do and this is what Jews don't do. And we also realized that to the extent there was still public Jewish life on the Lower East Side, it was sustained in the Orthodox institutions. So I started going back to shul again. But I also had a feeling, and as you probably know, Zalman, I also have a big brother who's a big Talmud Chacham, and he was becoming a professor of Talmud, and I was becoming a Yiddishist, and there is a certain hierarchy of prestige in Jewish studies between those fields, and I didn't want to be an Amaretz. And just like somebody had told me, hey, there's a shul where you'll fit in, somebody told me, hey, there's a class for adult beginners at the Yeshiva on East Broadway, MTJ. So I first walked in there probably one day in 1984. And for about 3 years, most weekday mornings, Monday through Thursday, spent 2 hours with two young rabbis and Yossi Rosenbaum and Shmuel Deitel, and one of them taught us Chumash for an hour, and one of them taught us Gemara for an hour, and we were in the best medrash with everybody else. Somehow it was this little kirev. It was a kirev table, right? But without the heavy-handed philosophizing or moralizing, we were brought in to learn, and that's what it's still like at MTJ. Anybody can come in and sit down and learn. And then I did lots of other things. I eventually went to law school. I was in an office for a number of years. I was teaching out of town. And then, as happens to people who have the old-fashioned kind of academic career, eventually it was my turn to have a year of leave. That was in 2012. Not an academic year, a spring semester followed by a fall semester. I had a couple of projects that I promised to do during those semesters. They were well in hand before 2012 started. And so I found myself in shul on the Lower East Side in the Bialystoker shul, talking to Rabbi Yisachar Ginsburg, who appears under a pseudonym in the book, my friend, and saying I had a year coming up, a year's leave, and I wasn't sure exactly how I was going to spend it. First thing he said was, "Wow, I'm in the wrong job. They're giving you a year, paying you for a year, and you don't have to work." And then he said, "Why don't you go to the Rosh Yeshiva's shir?" And I immediately said, "That's a great idea." So after 25 years in which I stepped into MDJ maybe half a dozen times, I ended up spending that year in the Rosh Yeshiva shir. I was introduced to one of the young rabbis who learns with college students. I guess they thought that I'd be a good fit for him, and I learned with him, and he introduced me to a couple of, I would say, the leading Talmidim in Reb David's students of Reb David's morning Talmud lesson.
So you mentioned Reb David. So you mentioned before the Rosh Yeshiva, the leader of the yeshiva.
Right.
What is the name of the leader of the yeshiva? And tell us a little bit about him.
Sure. His name now is Reb David Feinstein of blessed memory. And as you know, we just lost him less than a week ago. Even though I'm not there, I'm connected and I'm hearing and people, and this is not a young man, but the sense of loss is immense, and something that one would not guess at from walking into the yeshiva or seeing the very intimate room in which he taught his Talmud classes. Reb David was the son of Reb Moshe Feinstein. Really,
one of the major ultra orthodox legal decisors of the second half of the 20th century in America.
Absolutely, except I'm going to take a bit of issue with the term ultra orthodox, because I think part of the spirit of MTJ is, we're not modern Orthodox. We're not ultra Orthodox. We're doing it the right way. Right? We're following Reb Moshe. This is Orthodox. We're following the halacha. Now, we're not trying to be too modern, and we're not trying to show everybody how from we are. This is how we do it. Right? A different kind of traditionalism.
Sure. Yeah.
And Reb David, who is referred to as the Rosh Yeshiva, who took over for almost 35 years after his father's passing, and whom I call in the book Rebbe, because that's also what we called him, was not a charismatic person, but a very, very much beloved person, a very available person. Not an author of long learned commentaries, but somehow he achieved the status of the ultimate decider, the ultimate posek on major topics in Jewish law for the United States. And once again, as I had in the mid-1980s, I found a remarkably congenial milieu for me as somebody who was only slightly less illiterate than I had been in the mid-1980s, to sit and learn with guys who were doing it full time and had been for years. And I will add, and this is not a gratuitous thing to add, because it wouldn't necessarily be the case in other yeshivas, they thought it was cool that a professor was coming in to study with them. I never got the sense of, you know, what are you doing here? What do you really think? In MTJ, they call me the professor. And I tried to get them to, except for one friend whom I call Nasano in the book. And as you noticed, he's the one who calls me Yoinis and Aaron. And I really like that. So that's how I came to the place.
Right. So you touched on a drop about the kind of ethos in this particular yeshiva on the Lower East Side that you spent this time participating at. And if you could tell us, in what ways do you think that the students, the members of this yeshiva were similar, and in what ways do you think that they were really different than the typical yeshiva students you would find in an Orthodox or ultra-Orthodox yeshiva?
Well, first of all, beyond a certain minimum, which might be 18, 19 years, they are all male. I mean, it's like any Orthodox yeshiva in that respect, and that's a complex issue in itself, of course. But they are of all ages. That means that there are young men who are of college age who might be doing it for a couple years before they get married. There are a few men in their 30s and 40s who have decided that this is what they're doing with their life, who draw a very, very modest stipend from the institution. And honestly, because I didn't ask and I didn't do interviews and I was trying not to be too nosy, I can guess at how their families survive, but I don't always know. I know that in some cases, this is not atypical for the yeshiva world. It's common for their wives to have certain professional jobs, speech therapist, physical therapist, as well as taking care of the household, raising the children, right? So the contribution of women is immense here and shouldn't be underplayed, even though to some extent I have been fairly accused of underplaying it in the book itself because the women are not there. But there are also people who come in for a couple hours a day, and then there's another professor, right? He comes in the morning, and then he goes up to Baruch College to teach computing for accounting students. There are people who have jobs as mashkichim, and or teachers at MTJ who can come in for a couple of hours. And there are people who are retired from a range of jobs. In some ways, yes, there is a kollel.
Meaning a program for people who are already married and then continuing their rabbinic learning after marriage.
That's right. That's right. And some people are doing it indefinitely. And there are always a few men there who were studying for smicha, rabbinical ordination. Last few years, it's been a two or three lovely young Bratslava Hasidim who come in from Brooklyn to study in Yiddish, which is fairly unusual at MTJ, but they just fit in beautifully there somehow. But I would almost say if it didn't somehow detract from the honor of the place, of which I'm very protective, I'd almost be tempted to say this is the community Beis Medrash. This is the community study house on the Lower East Side, more than a separate institution with imaginary walls around it.
And you talk about the fact, and you sort of just alluded to it, that in this yeshiva, unlike in a typical yeshiva, there isn't one program of study. So you just mentioned that some of the people who join the study hall are learning to for smicha, they're learning for rabbinic ordination. They're not even learning the typical texts of the Talmud. And even when it comes to the text of the Talmud, different students are reading different books.
Right. Right,
and this is not typical in a typical.
That's right. That's right. We should explain further that in a typical Orthodox yeshiva, if it's let's say if it's big enough that there are ranked classes, then at least everybody in a class will be studying the same text, and will be keying their individual or paired study, which is how they spend most of the day, off an hour or two lecture that is given by a more experienced reader in that particular text. At MTJ, under Reb David, there were a number of people who would attend his lessons, his shiur, and would spend a good part of the day preparing for his shiur and then reviewing what he had just said. But other people are studying on their own. Other people are studying in pairs or small groups. There's a range of any Talmudic text is fair game. Any recognized major early modern to modern legal code or commentary is fair game. And study groups kind of form and dissolve naturally.
Right. So this is a very different system.
it's a very different system. I recount in the book stories that were told to me about that when attempts were made to sort of regularize it and have everybody studying the same. And the person who told me said, it lasted for a couple of months and then it kind of broke down. You know? And I'm gonna say this in public for the first time. A neighbor who was very observant in both senses, right? A good analyst and a knowledgeable and practicing Jew said to me, and I've phrased it this way, there are some yeshivas that we call kiruv yeshivas, right? Where the object is to draw in unaffiliated Jews and make them feel warmer toward the tradition and more knowledgeable and become resources for the community, to enlarge the community. There are other yeshivas where it's not a nice way to put it, but where they almost have their brand, right? Where especially a prospective in-laws family would have a sense of what they're getting if, you know, if you say he's a Chafetz Chaim guy, he's a Torah V'Das guy.
Right. Someone who went to a particular ultra-Orthodox yeshiva.
Right. With a certain style, a certain level of orthodoxy, a certain range. MTJ isn't like that. And what my friend said was, at MTJ, the people are there because they want to be learning in a Beis Medrash. And I think that actually captures a lot of what's special about it also.
Right. Right. And related to this, you mentioned in the book that I got the impression that many, if not most or all, of the members of the study hall at this yeshiva are sort of older than the typical yeshiva student. And at the same time, it seemed like many of them were more worldly than the typical yeshiva student. You recount that they talked about movies or popular movies or books like The Third Man. And they also had a less of a, I don't know, a tolerance or inclination to support some of the more recent stringencies in halakha, in Jewish law, for instance, in terms of just how strict they were about the gender segregation when there were public events separating men and women, that they tended to be less severe than is common these days in Orthodox or ultra-Orthodox circles. And I'm wondering, in what ways did you feel that this, both the age and the kind of the Weltanschauung or the orientation of the people at the yeshiva, in what sense did you feel that it impacted their approach to learning, their approach to the Talmud, their interpretation of the Talmud, and so on?
It's a really, really great question. You know, I just to expand on what you were very aptly summarizing from the book about the mood of the place, I'm sure you noticed the one illustration I have in the book, right? There is one figure. It's labeled figure one, right? It has no caption. And I took this photograph, and I'm not a great photographer, but I couldn't resist. One of the, in terms of a masara, a tradition, and a sense of what is special about this place and where it comes from, a lot of that comes from the image and the aura of Reb Moshe Feinstein, right? Our late Reb David's father, who issued a number of authoritative and radical rulings at the same time. My rabbi at the community synagogue on 6th Street a number of years ago, Rabbi Avi Berkowitz, said to me, you know, the definition of a Haredi Jew, or ultra-Orthodox is the term you're using, is somebody who accepts all of Reb Moshe Feinstein's stringent rulings and none of his lenient rulings. And the definition of a modern Orthodox Jew, you can guess this, is someone who accepts none of Reb Moshe Feinstein's stringent rulings and all of his lenient rulings.
I that's really phenomenal. I just want to interject that I remember explicitly, I grew up in the Lubavitch Hasidic community in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, and I distinctly remember people, rabbis in the community saying when the status of Reb Moshe Feinstein came up, that they said he was a tremendous Jew, a tremendous scholar and halachic authority, but we don't accept any of his kolos. We don't accept any of the leniencies that he introduced, whether about, you know, in terms of Jews using cholov akum or non cholov Yisrael, milk that's not specifically handled by Jews, which is a big issue in the Orthodox world, and many other things. We totally accept Rabbi Feinstein as a person, as a sort of religious figure, but we don't accept any of his leniencies. So I'm certainly aware of this type of embrace, sort of partial embrace, right, of the man.
Right, right. So you mentioned Chol of Yisrael, the question, the complex question of whether for dairy products to be, I don't know if not kosher, but appropriate for consumption, certain aspects of the process have to be handled by Jews. And Rav Moshe held at least that it was not a requirement where it would be unduly burdensome to only use such dairy products. And in fact, in the people my age and younger who grew up in the neighborhood remember that in the yeshiva and in the summer camps, it was regular OU milk that was used.
Not with the extra stringencies.
Not with the extra stringencies. So there are people in the yeshiva who want to respect that and maintain that. They're not going to suddenly say, because everybody else only has the more stringent standard, we're going to adopt that as well. But they're also aware that most of the people who come into the yeshiva at this point do hold those stringencies and may not understand that the more lenient standards are acceptable at MTJ as well. So the one photograph in the book is of a commercial cake that is kosher, but not Cholov Yisroel, on a table with a handwritten note next to it saying, "This cake is OU, not Cholov Yisroel, enjoy." Right? So they wanted to tell people, but they also wanted to say it's kosher and you're welcome to have it. In some ways, that's a losing battle because the Lower East Side community has been shrinking somewhat, and because the tone is set more by, look, you're a sociologist, Zalman, so it's not going to surprise you when I say that as an anthropologist, I noticed a long time ago that the more people want to be in a certain club or neighborhood, the more exclusive it can be. So in these dynamic growing Orthodox communities, the tendency to stringency has been and is indulged more than on the Lower East Side. And I think the Rosh Yeshiva Zal, Reb David Feinstein, I'm talking about now, my Rosh Yeshiva, was very aware of this and was trying hard at once to sustain his father's standards and legacy and to respect and to make sure that the MTJ community was part of the larger centrist and Haredi Orthodox world. Once in Shiur, I remember we were reading a Rashi, and he was talking about Rashi, and he said, you know, the real Frumis call him the Heiliger Rashi, right? And he said, and we should too.
All right. So Rashi is a commentator on the Talmud, and the Frumis, the Frum, is the ultra-Orthodox, the very right. Orthodox.
Right. So in other words, he was recognizing some, you know, some distinction there, but saying, that's fine. That's great. That's great that they have that attitude.
Right, they view Rashi, this medieval commentator, as heilig, as holy, not just as an intellectual contributor to the discourse.
Right, and I'll tell you another one, and then you or I can explain the term I'm using here. I kept going to the Shiur, and I mean, without this damned COVID, I mean, I would still be going to MTJ, and I hope to. I really miss it. It wasn't just like a year of fieldwork, and then I'm out of there. I love the place. I feel attached to it still. But one time during that year, I think, we were studying the Tractate Gittin, which is about divorces, and there's a complex discussion of a witness. One witness signed his name in Hebrew and another witness signed his name in Greek. And Rashi has a discussion of what he thinks signing the name in Greek means. And I came in one morning, I had thought about it a lot. And I said to one of my study partners, you know, I think Rashi's wrong. And he said to me, you can't say Rashi's wrong. Can't say Rashi's wrong. Maybe he didn't know the Metzius.
He didn't know the facts on the ground.
Facts on the ground, but you can't say he's wrong.
All right. Well, so this goes to my previous question about sort of what are the boundaries of the discourse, and you
mentioned
this in the book that there are boundaries. It's a very bounded environment, and the discourse itself of the study of the Talmud or other classical Jewish texts that are being studied, there are boundaries to you know, just what kinds of questions could be asked, what kinds of questions are allowed, and yet the boundaries, my sense is that they are much more sort of expansive or more freeing than they would be in a sort of typical Orthodox or ultra-Orthodox yeshiva.
I think that's true. And I have to be very careful here, both because I was always very careful about pushing them. I was more interested in learning what the rules are than trying to see what I could get away with. And partly because, frankly, it's fun to play within the rules. If the rules give enough play. But one of the things I noticed, and I have an analysis at one point, I hope I explained it, I'm not sure, where it was clear that the relevant rule is ultimately all statements of rabbis of a certain stratum called the Tanaim. Those are the rabbis whose statements are collected in the Mishnah and in other scattered dicta that were preserved, form a single system. So wherever possible, the rabbis of the Talmud and then the commentaries that build upon them will try to reconcile seeming contradictions. And I realized at one point that it would be very easy if you simply said, well, this one statement from that Tanaitic period that's quoted simply disagrees. It's from the same period, but it's a different tradition where this whole issue was categorized differently, you know, and it's not a big problem. When we discussed it in, I think it was the same topic, when we discussed it in the Shir with the Rosh Yeshiva, I spoke up, and I didn't speak up much, and often I wasn't heard, but I said, Rebbe, it seems very forced. And he said, it is forced. They want you to work really hard at it.
Right. So the Rosh Yeshiva didn't feel that the fact that the interpretation to reconcile these two seemingly contradictory statements from two different people during the same period in history, the fact that you needed to work hard to reconcile them, that doesn't in any way challenge the authenticity or the truthfulness of the interpretation.
It's this odd phenomenon where the stronger is the unspoken shared assumption that you can lean on this tradition really hard and it's not going to break, the more you can lean on it. And I'll give you another moment. I don't know if this is unique to MTJ, but it was a treasured experience for me and really something that came up, didn't get into the book, partly because it happened after I'd basically finished the book. We're studying the tractate Midos, which is not about good character traits, but about the measurements of the temple. And there's a discussion of the big stones and the walls and the dimensions of the walls and so forth. And it's very hard to make it all kind of line up. And a group of us were preparing for this year, three or four of us studying at a time. And I just stopped a second and I said, you know, what we're trying to do here is to, through talking, assemble a shared image in our separate heads of what the temple looked like. We are trying to recreate the temple in our heads. And I was just extremely moved by that, what we're trying to do.
Right. But many times, even if it's a more sort of mundane topic or a topic that seemingly, you know, should be, you know, fairly straightforward, like if one ox gores another ox, it turns out that there's a tremendous possibility for all sorts of complications, and especially once you get into the different strata of the Talmud, so the text itself, then the sort of first generation commentators, the second generation commentators, third generation commentators, it could be very hard to, as you say, make it all line up, especially if you believe, as some Orthodox Jews do, that not only was the Bible, the Mishnah, which is an early rabbinic compilation, and the Talmud, which is a discussion and explication of the Mishnah, but even much, much later, commentators going into the middle or early modern period were all written, quote unquote, with divine inspiration. When you put that type of viewpoint on all of these texts, then it really does become very, very difficult, if not impossible, to make them all reconcile in such a way where, as you said, you can't say Rashi was wrong. You can't say that even other more recent commentators were wrong. Then again, it's very could be very, very difficult to make them all sort of line up in a way that's still logical.
And at the same time, you mentioned some of the later commentators or late medieval, the Tosafists, right? Rashi's, one of whom was, at least literally, was Rashi's grandson. Enormously detailed and long commentaries. This is, for people who have not seen a page of the standard edition of the printed Talmud, there are folios where there are about three lines of text surrounded by thousands of words in tiny print of commentary, raising seeming inconsistencies between different portions of this huge compendium called the Talmud that nobody would have ever thought of as problems until they were raised, and then going through I don't want to say somersaults, but going through rich intellectual exercises to resolve them. And sometimes it works, and sometimes it's very hard to understand. And when Reb David Feinstein Zatzal didn't understand it, he would say, "We don't speak the language of the Tosafists. If we knew their language, we would understand this better. It's time to move on." He would struggle with it, but eventually he would say, "It's time to move on." And at a certain point, he would say, "This is bittul Torah, right? To obsess where you're not getting it is cheating you of the opportunity to keep learning new things." So a certain degree of humility and almost of rahmanas for everybody else, right? Of compassion for everybody else in the group moderates that attitude toward the Heilige Rashi.
Right, and I remember when I read one of the passages where you describe this sort of attitude or procedure on the part of the Rosh Yeshiva, where he would try as hard as possible to reconcile things, and then if it didn't go, he said, "Okay, you know, it's time to move on." I thought that was really a profound kind of balancing. On the one hand, trying to accept the holiness and the validity of every aspect of the Talmud and all of the levels of commentators, and at the same time being intellectually honest and saying, "Look, you know, he didn't say it explicitly, but it's sort of implied. We might not be able to reconcile all of this, and let's not try to, you know, pretend that we could, because that would really be a disservice to our own intellects and
exactly.
Our own." You know,
exactly.
Capacity.
Exactly. And related to that, or somewhat different nuance, is his procedure as a teacher. His son, Rabbi Morty Feinstein, said in his eulogy last Sunday, one thing which also I kind of wished I had put this in my book, that but it rang so true. He said that when his father taught his Talmud class, it was each time as if he himself were studying it for the first time. No way was it the first time. But he wanted to present the difficulties to the class, not like show off, here, I've got it now, and I'm going to tell you how to read this. We're going to struggle through this together. And that meant first reading it, whatever the unit was, without any of the commentaries, not bringing in the Rashi immediately, line by line. Learning the text itself, then bringing in the Rashi, then bringing in the Tosos. So to people who are familiar, you could say, "Oh, ripped up. I just saw a Gemara, a blot shear with Rashi and Tosfos. It wasn't that simple. And that's why one of my study partners said to me one day, people ask me why I've been sitting in the Rosh Hashiva's shir for so many years, and I tell them because I want to learn, I want to learn how to learn like the Rebbe learns. Hard to summarize.
Right, right. And speaking of methods, I think it's really fascinating, your book, the kind of methodology that you use and the particular style, you know, of putting it all together. And you note that that you don't necessarily include, so it includes a lot of stories, a lot of very rich details of your experiences at this yeshiva, studying in, by yourself, studying in peers, studying in larger groups, studying with the Rosh Yeshiva, and what, you know, happened during that year and in other periods of time when you were spending time at this yeshiva, but you yourself note that you don't always include an analysis or commentary that would be common in anthropological works. Why did you choose to do it this way?
First of all, because I'm not as young an anthropologist as I once was, and look, with my previous book about the Lower East Side, Mornings at the Stanton Street Shul. One of my severest critics is a cousin and close friend who's a social psychologist. And since I started in this business, he has loved my work with Jewish memoirs, my ethnographies. He doesn't like it when I write critical theory. He finds it really pretentious and just sort of trying to, you know, make a name for myself. After he read my book about the Stanton Street Shul, he said, you know, the theory is there if you know what you're looking for. And I kind of hope to be at that stage where this is an intervention in anthropological discussions of the so-called split between the religious and the secular, and really trying to emphasize the ways in which I understood how they were talking, and I could talk that way too. And they understood how I was talking, and there were things I could bring in at the edges that did fit. In other words, emphasizing the overlap in the Venn diagram rather than the here are two worlds confronting each other. That's part of it. Part of it is I knew from the time, I don't know from the time I walked in, but from the time where I thought, you know, I might write a book about this, that I would only do so if I felt I was writing a book that I could bring into the Beis Medrash, that I could give to the people there. And part of that is what you say about them, what you don't say. And part of it is also writing it in a language that ordinary people can understand. You know, Zalman, when I mentioned in at one point I was a lawyer and I went to law school, and I had already published a fair amount of anthropology and critical theory when I went to law school. And in my first year in law school, I wrote a long paper actually about the Kiryas Yoel Supreme Court case, which was still fairly new then in the 1990s. And I wanted to publish it in the law journal. So I brought it to the writing teacher, the writing instructor at the law school. And a few days later, he gave it back to me. He had marked up the first couple pages. He said, I didn't have time to mark up the whole thing. But to paraphrase Jackie Mason, can't you write like a normal person? So I've been trying very hard since then. You know, especially when I want normal people to read it, to write like a normal person. And the last influence on the style, I do mention it in the book, is my hero Walter Benjamin. And that especially the parts of the book where it's one brief anecdote with a title after another that are intended to be a mosaic that produce a composite portrait that I got especially from Walter Benjamin.
Right, right. Well, one thing related to the style that was interesting to me is that you often presented stories that either you said, well, it could be that the person did this for this reason. It could be that the person did it for this reason. We're really not sure, you know? And who cares which, you know, what the reason is? And then other times you would present a story and you wouldn't say that last piece that I just said, but it was obvious that it was an ambiguous story, but it's really not clear, you know, does it mean this or does it mean that? And it seemed again that you kind of took pleasure in presenting stories that could be interpreted in multiple different ways.
I love that kind of story. You know, that's what most of the stories in the Talmud are like.
It's true. Well, speaking of which, it's interesting that as I was reading your book, and I took so much pleasure. I mean, it's a really fascinating, fascinating work. So thank you for birthing it to the world and sharing it with us. As I was reading it, I kept on thinking, first I thought, well, this is an anthropological work because you're an anthropologist. And then as I kept on reading, and especially when you would describe a story where one speaker referenced a second speaker or a second person, you know, and it suddenly dawned on me, this is a lot like the structure in the Talmud, where you have a statement from one rabbi and that rabbi quotes another rabbi. And I wondered if that was intentional. And then just before I let you answer, I should say that sometimes in your work, it seemed to me that we crossed over from the Talmud to Hasidut, to Hasidic stories. And there was one of my favorite moments in the book is where you describe a quote-unquote miracle where a piece of paper that was placed into a rabbinic text supposedly disappeared. And then I thought, it sounds like this book is a work of Hasidic lore. So what is it? Help us out here. What's going on here?
Well, actually, my wife read the book and she said, oh, it's about you. as my ethnographic writing usually is, and since my first book, I'm present in it. I don't know how to write otherwise. The anthropologist is very much present. And the anthropologist is the medium. I think it's dishonest for the anthropologist not to be present in the ethnography in some way, although I may overdo it at certain points. One of the reviewers for the Stanton Street Shul book called it solipsistic. That's a little harsh, but I get that. Look, some stories about Rosh Yeshivas, about misnagdic rabbis, are not that different, really, from stories about Hasidic rebbes also. Usually these are about things that look like miracles and create a sense of wonder, but don't require a belief in the miraculous per se. In the various printed and recorded eulogies for Reb David Feinstein that have been coming out in the last few days. One of them quoted him as saying, you know, it sounds like people might think that what I say is going to happen happens, or when I give a bracha, a blessing, the thing wished for happens. That's because nobody tells over the times it doesn't work out. I mean, he said that himself, right? And the truth is, Zalman, a lot of the Hasidic rabbis would tell you that too, right? They didn't necessarily promote so much the idea that they had this special skill. When they were blessing people, they were encouraging them. They weren't saying, I've got the goods and I know what's going to happen, necessarily. And, you know, if there are Hasidic stories, why shouldn't there be tales of them? My brother Daniel says that this book should be called Tales of the Misnagdim.
I'm glad at least I wasn't totally off the mark.
Right.
Okay.
And look, there is more rapprochement between the Hasidic and the traditional yeshivish worlds. There aren't these deep walls anymore.
Right. And speaking of the Venn diagram and trying to find the soft spot that, you know, where the different circles meet, it was interesting to me throughout the book, but especially towards the end, you talk about this idea of Torah Lishma, to learn Torah, quote unquote, for its own sake. And you essentially end up arguing that it's possible to look at the yeshiva, the studying that happens in the yeshiva as an example of this studying for its own sake, and that this is in a way a kind of resistance to the neoliberal market forces that we think about that are, you know, pervade our society, where even in higher education, secular education, so much of the thinking and motivation around pursuing a degree is, well, what could I get out of it? What could I get out of it? The utilitarian side of it. And that, ironically, maybe to some people, the yeshiva, which may seem like such a foreign and, you know, just a totally different world, that actually the kind of studying that they're doing there, which is really not based on some kind of utilitarian outcome that they're hoping to achieve, is a kind of resistance, of all things, to neoliberalism. And I thought that was really just a fascinating take.
Yeah, I mean, look, with any luck, people will be arguing for years over that claim I made in this book, and I'll be thinking about it more. But I can amplify it a bit by saying that when I first spent time in the yeshiva in the 1980s, and I was had just gotten my PhD, and I knew that academic job prospects were pretty dim, one of the things that attracted me about it was that it was an alternative alternative space for intellectual discourse, where you didn't need a particular degree to participate, and where it wasn't a publish or perish situation. And to some extent, 30 years later, I'm saying the same thing. Only now what I'm saying is it's not about production, and it's not about reaching the goal so that you've now accumulated more. And the idea, I mean, in my more sentimental modes, and maybe I was smart enough not to put this in the book, but I said to people in the Best Medrash a couple of times, I said, you know, now I understand why they say that if you're really, really good in this life, this is what you get to do in the world to come. There are moments, right? I'm not saying I don't get bored or sleepy or alienated when I'm sitting and learning with people for a few hours. But there are moments where the rest of the world falls away and you're working together in this groove. And it's like Lahavdil being part of a jazz quartet that's just jamming really tight.
That it does sound very enticing.
You know, in some ways, I've emphasized the enticing parts. I know that.
But it's funny because you mentioned in the book that the yeshiva that you participated in doesn't really do much publicity. It doesn't really, I mean, there's a annual dinner, but it's really kind of a low-key operation. They don't do much PR. And I thought as I was reading it, maybe this is the PR for the yeshiva, that, you know, anyone who reads it, or many people who read this might really be enticed to participate and to try to experience that intellectual bliss that you just mentioned.
We'll see. Halavai. If they do, I hope they find it. I hope they find it. And also, with all due respect for the traditions that MTJ represents, I am obligated to say that these are opportunities that should be available to Jewish women as well.
Right, right. As you said, this is a all-male space.
Right.
Right, right. Well, before I let you go, I always ask guests to talk a little bit about any thing that they're working on now or their next project, if they could share with us. So if you could share anything.
Yeah, actually, together with my son, Jonah, who is also a Yiddishist, and I'm pleased to say he's not a struggling academic, but deeply loves Yiddish and Yiddishkeit and deeply committed to the welfare of Jews, especially in New York City. He and I have started working on translation of, I was going to say a volume, it's actually two volumes, published in Yiddish in 1923 and 1928, edited by a man named Mordechai Lipson, whom we don't know enough about yet. And it's called Die Welt der Zelt, which means, we translate it, people tell the story. And it's a collection of anecdotes about Anshei Shem, notable Jews, mostly in the 19th century, mostly but not all rabbis, mostly but not all in Eastern Europe, mostly but not all religious figures. Some of them actually anti-religious figures. There's a story about a famous apikoros in a certain town, a heretic, who, when he was dying, said, called his most loyal son over and said, look, I have you and one other son and a daughter, and your brother, he's converted to Christianity. There's no way he's going to say Kaddish, the memorial prayer, for me. Your daughter's, your sister's a girl. She can't say Kaddish. So I am imploring you, son, please, don't you say Kaddish for me either.
Wow. Well, that really sounds like an amazing story and a very
that's colorful
typical collection.
That's atypical, but it gives you a sense of how rich and complex and dynamic this world was, all compressed into these little one paragraph, one page anecdotes. So that's what we're working on now.
Wow, I very much look forward to seeing that when that comes out. I want to thank you for taking the time to share your thoughts with us today. I really appreciate it.
And I've enjoyed the conversation, and it's really gratifying to me to have a conversation that is based on such a rich and generous reading of the book on your part. Thank you, Zalman.
Our pleasure. That concludes our program. Thanks for listening and have a great day.